I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Arroyo Grande, California. We're here with Jim Gregory, historian, author, and retired history teacher at Mission College Prep. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
It's 2017. 75 years ago, the world turned upside down right here in Arroyo Grande on the Central Coast. Tell us about the game changer.
It would have been April of 1942, and it was the day before trout season, which is, if you're an Arroyo Grande boy, that's a date you kind of hold sacrosanct. Ken Cabarra remembered that. Ken Cabarra was Nisei, an American-born Japanese.
Second generation.
And that would have been the day when a line of Greyhound buses appeared about 200 yards from where we're sitting up on Crown Hill to pick up the residents of the South County of Japanese descent and take them to a relocation center at the Tulare County Fairgrounds. So this was the execution of Executive Order 9066.
Let's back up and let's rewind for a moment. December 7th, 1941 was a powerful, just mind-blowing day for everybody. And for the Japanese especially, the Nisei and Issei that lived here, it must have been a doubly horrific day for them.
It was. The news would have gotten here via CBS and Bob Trout, who mispronounced Oahu as Wahoo, I think, about 11:30 in the morning. And about that time, the Ikeda family, who were Methodists, would have been, like most other families in Arroyo Grande, getting ready for Sunday lunch. It would become apparent within 2 weeks that we had already taken our first casualties. There were two Arroyo Grande sailors named Jack Scruggs and Wayne Morgan who were killed on Battleship Arizona. So for Arroyo Grandians, including our Japanese neighbors, the war came very quickly and very brutally.
The Nisei and Issei that you've talked with and interviewed that lived in the South County, after Pearl Harbor, what did they think? Did they have a sense that they would be interned and bussed away?
I don't think they did at first. They were certainly anxious. I spoke at great length with Haru Hayashi, who is a longtime farmer. His father came here from Japan. Haru was a sophomore in high school. At the time of the Pearl Harbor attack, he was recovering from appendicitis and was at home. So he was very anxious about returning to school after Pearl Harbor. When he did, he didn't feel any animosity. His closest friends, Don Gullickson, John Loomis, and Gordon Bennett, they were kind of the four musketeers. And the toughest kid at Arroyo Grande Union High School was an Italian-American kid named Milt Gugia. And he came up to Haru, took him aside, and says, "Haru, yes?" He says, "If anybody calls you a Jap, let me know, and I will personally beat the crap out of them." So there was, at first, there was anxiety, but there wasn't the kind of anxiety that you would have anticipated being taken away from your home and sent far across the country.
The other dynamic of the South County of the Central Coast was the number of Japanese who lived here. As I recall, close to 50% of the students at Arroyo Grande High School were Japanese. That's incredible.
That's right. 25 of the 58 members of the class of 1942 were Nisei. And what's heartbreaking to me, since I grew up here, went to school in Arroyo Grande, later taught at Arroyo Grande High School, I knew many of these families, the Ikedas, Kabaras, Hayashis, the Fuchiwakis. But if you look in the annual from 1942, I don't recognize the surnames of many of these young people. It's estimated that fewer than half of the Japanese who were interned from Arroyo Grande would come back home after the war.
Interesting. And the reasons why, was there any explanation why they moved away?
Well, near the end of the war in 1945, by then many of the young people had found jobs. They could leave the internment camps. They had employment in places like Chicago, for example. My friend Ben Dewey went to university in Missouri, Kazaketa top sugar beets in New Mexico and Utah. So many of them found jobs, and there was kind of a standing invitation in 1945 from the governor of Colorado, who recognized these were model citizens. So he extended an invitation for you West Coast Japanese, if you'd like to become Coloradans, you're more than welcome, and many of them did.
One of the disconnects of this moment in time, it's been said over and over again that in many respects, the Japanese Nisei and Sensei that lived on the Central Coast were in many ways as American or more American than the Americans. They very much melted into society, baseball, and when I talk about that Americanism of the Japanese that lived here.
You cite baseball, which Japanese Americans had a passion for, and one of the great stories, one of the great families of the Rio Grande area is the Loomis family. They owned an insurance agency and a farm supply store where I bought my baby chicks when I was a little guy. But Vard was a pitcher at Stanford. He graduated, came back into the family business, and Jusso Aketa, who's one of the farmers of the upper Rio Grande Valley, asked Vard if he would be interested in managing a team. And that team became the All-Nisei Rio Grande Growers. And they were a terrific baseball team. Kaz Aketa, who was a catcher at Cal Poly, one of his brothers played infield at Cal Poly. They were among the team's stars. So they barnstormed throughout the Central Valley and up and down the California coast playing other Nisei teams. And they were a wonderful, wonderful team.
Talk a little bit more about the patriotic dimension of the Japanese here.
They were so completely integrated. Again, you can see that from the old high school yearbooks. They were student body officers. They were athletes, basketball, baseball, football. One of my favorite characters from the book I wrote about World War II, Rio Grande, was named George Nakamura. Nakamura was the sports editor of the Rio Grande Union High School newspaper, the High Chatter, and he would go on to win a Bronze Star. As an Army intelligence sergeant, he would rescue an American flyer who had been shot down in the interior of China. So Nakamura was not only a brilliant young man, he was engaging, and after his death, about 5 years ago, he never came back to Rio Grande, but he asked his son Gary to bring his ashes here to be buried.
Wow.
So he came home again.
That was pretty cool. Rewinding back, it's April 1942. We're in Rio Grande, and a line of Greyhound buses show up in town with United States Army bayonets fixed. The Japanese are loaded on the buses and taken away to Manzanar, Tule Lake, and other internment camps. And all of a sudden, hundreds of Japanese citizens of the Central Coast are gone. And their farms, their farmhouses are abandoned. Two things happen, negative and positive. Tell us about that aftermath.
As tragic as the so-called evacuation of the Japanese was, there were a lot of circumstances that really make me proud to be from Rio Grande. On the day the buses left, the Rio Grande Women's Club brought box lunches to the people who were about to leave. Many farmers and neighbors came out to say goodbye. One woman remembered a string of five or six high school girls, some Nisei, some Caucasian, walking up the hill to the Crown Hill campus, holding hands and crying. Then those buses came down the hill, and they went along Branch Street. So all the businesses and stores that these kids had grown up with, ending with the two churches, Methodist and Catholic, just before you get on to 101, they didn't know whether they would ever see these places again. And in fact, many of them never did. They would be taken to a temporary relocation center at the Tulare County Fairgrounds. We hear of the Japanese who slept in horse stalls at Santa Anita. San Luis Obispo County's Japanese slept in animal stalls that had been used for exhibitions during the Tulare County Fair, and they still stank of manure. They would stay there for several months, and what they would do during those 3 or 4 months at Tulare was incredible. They started a newspaper. They formed baseball and softball leagues. They started their own schools. They formed their own self-governing kind of city council. And what they achieved in that short amount of time before they were ultimately sent to their permanent camp was simply remarkable. They created a community.
Back to here in town and in the country, their farms, some of them were just getting ready to plant.
Right.
Their houses were abandoned. And there were incidents where people came and broke into their houses and stole all their belongings.
Yeah.
There were also touching stories. Mr. Loomis, for example, talked to us about how he stepped up to the plate.
The Loomis family, the book I wrote about World War II is dedicated to one of the Loomises, Joe, who is a dear friend of mine growing up here. It has always been noted for its selflessness, and World War II was no exception. The Loomis brothers, who ran the family business, E.C. Loomis and son, watched over the property and the farm equipment of several families, the Fukuharas and the Aketas included. Pete Pacino, who was an insurance agent who was tragically killed he was a Cal Poly booster, was killed in the 1960 Toledo plane crash, took care of his Japanese customers' cars for the duration. There were others, Silveras, Phelans, Taylors. These families, to use a cliche, really stepped up to the plate and, again, watched over their neighbor's property and their equipment. When Haru Hayashi, who I mentioned before, came back from the war, he found that he pretty much could pick up right where his father had left off in 1942 because of this. And it wasn't entirely successful. There was an old dehydration shed that the Loomis brothers used to store furniture and other personal belongings of their Japanese friends. That was broken into, the examples like the ones you cite, and much of that stuff was either vandalized or stolen during the war.
What other most touching, memorable things do you recall of all your studies and conversations?
Since I'm a former Rio Grande High School teacher, I'm very, very proud of the then principal, a young man named Clarence Burrell. And I'm very close to the Fuchiwaki family. I went to high school with two of the daughters of Hilo Fuchiwaki, who served in Army intelligence. Well, one Fuchiwaki daughter was kind of the babysitter for Clarence Burrell's small children. Another worked as a secretary at the high school. When he began to intuit that there would be an evacuation, this would have been about this time of year, February in 1942, he had the course of study accelerated for the Nisei sophomores so they could graduate on time. Because they were taken away before graduation, they didn't get their diplomas. So Burrell put their diplomas in his car and personally drove to the Tulare County camp. And in a little ceremony, he conferred the diplomas on the class of 1942. That took a tremendous amount of moral courage. This was not a popular thing to do at the time. You know, other examples toward the end of the war, when the Kabara family was one of the first to come back. They were fairly established, and they would kind of shepherd the other families as they returned gradually from Gila River, which is where our neighbors wound up. Mrs. Kabara came into a store to do some shopping for her family and the other families they were taking care of. There were several. They'd been turned down, by the way. They were also taking care of Santa Maria families because no hotel in Santa Maria would allow them to stay in 1945. Mrs. Kabara did her grocery shopping, and then the proprietor of the store, I don't know which store it was, I don't particularly want to know, told her to never come back again. Now, one of the women...
This was after?
This was right after the war, yeah.
Oh.
Right. The head of the Rio Grande Women's Club was Mrs. Taylor, who was the wife of a prominent local farmer. She was outraged. And I don't know what she said at the next meeting of the Rio Grande Women's Club, but I think it peeled the wallpaper off the walls. Kimi Kabara, the woman who was told never to come back, said that the atmosphere improved immediately. And for me personally, as a teacher, the payoff was wonderful because I got to teach two of Eileen Taylor's great-grandchildren and three of Kimi Kabara's great-grandchildren.
The healing process, how long did it take?
In some ways, it's difficult to tell. The problem is that the people who were interned internalized so much. My peers growing up, Sansei, third generation, their parents refused to talk about the camp experience. Mm-hmm. And it was only as many of them began to get into their 80s and 90s that they began talking to informants, oral historians, Cal Poly students who gathered some wonderful interviews. So some of that, I think, is still there. It's deeply submerged. But this was something that cut Rio Grande very deep.
Jim Gregory, always a pleasure to visit and learn from you. If somebody wanted to learn more about you and your writings and your books as they relate to Central Coast history,
you can either go to my website, which is very simple to find, riograndehistory.com, or I have an author page on amazon.com that talks more about my two books about local history.
Excellent. Jim Gregory, thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Rio Grande, California.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. Our associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, and Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkan Songs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
going.
Now, wait a minute, Costello.